on the financial management of our healthcare programs, meaning our public healthcare programs, and so we're anxious to have them give us an overview of that study. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Joel Alter with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and Valerie Bombach is here with me as well. When we started this evaluation that we conducted over the past several months, legislators had a variety of questions that they asked us to try to take a look at. Things like, how much does the state spend to administer the public health care programs? Can we really trust the spending numbers that are being reported by the health plans on spending? Should Minnesota continue to contract with private managed care organizations? And what do we know about the cost effectiveness of county-based purchasing? We certainly don't claim in this report to have all of the answers, but I hope that this report provides a useful overview of what clearly is one of the most important functions of state government and also one of the more expensive functions. What I'd like to do today is just begin with some brief background, and you obviously know the public programs well, so I'll be brief in doing that. And then I'd like to shift into a brief discussion of the state's cost containment efforts, offer some comments and recommendations that relate to managed care, as well as fee-for-service, and then conclude with some observations on county-based purchasing. Overall, our report does not suggest scrapping the state's existing methods of purchasing health care for low-income people and starting over. The general approaches that Minnesota uses are similar to those used by many, if not most, states. We do think there's room for improvement to ensure that the state is getting good value for the money that it spends. Also, we examined efforts to contain cost in publicly funded health care programs. That includes basic health care, long-term care, and related services. And we concluded that these efforts have had mixed results and that there's more work to do to ensure that Minnesota's already high costs for publicly funded health care services are not higher than necessary. As you know, Minnesota has three health care programs for low-income people: medical assistance, Minnesota Care, general assistance, medical care. And altogether, Minnesota spent about $6.5 billion for these programs last year, with a little more than half of the money coming from the state. Medical assistance is the largest program. And I should mention that medical assistance, as shown here, includes some of the sub-programs that you're familiar with, like the MSHO, the Minnesota Senior Health Options Program, or the Special Needs Basic Care Program are included within the medical assistance bar shown here. The state's administrative costs are not a large slice of Minnesota's $6.5 billion pie for publicly funded health care programs. Still, the dollar amounts for administrative spending are sizable. That includes over $100 million annually by DHS and about $200 million by the health plans that administer the public programs on behalf of the state. DHS uses two approaches to purchase health care and long-term care for low-income people. Those approaches are managed care and fee-for-service. Managed care typically means contracting with health plans and paying them a predetermined capitation payment, that is, an amount per enrollee for providing services. The health plans are responsible for expenditures that exceed the capitation payments, and they can keep portions of the payments that they don't spend. The Department of Human Services contracts with six managed care organizations for the delivery of those services and with three county-based purchasing organizations. Under fee-for-service, thousands of health care providers enroll with DHS to serve clients in the public programs, and then when the providers deliver an authorized service to a public client, they can bill DHS for the cost of those services. On the chart, a couple things to notice. The first is that managed care accounts for close to two-thirds of the enrollees in Minnesota's Medicaid program. That percentage has been growing in this state, as it has been in many states over the last decade. The chart also shows that fee-for-service, at least as of 2006, accounts for a majority of the Medicaid spending for health care and long-term care. And that's because a lot of the higher-cost enrollees, for example, people with disabilities, have tended to be served in fee-for-service care. Previous studies have indicated that Minnesota's Medicaid spending per enrollee is quite a bit higher than the national average. in the range of 40 to 50% higher. And part of the reason is that Minnesota has made policy choices to cover a wider array of services than some other states. For example, we cover things in Minnesota like chiropractor services, occupational and physical therapy, dentures, behavioral health services, some things that other states don't always cover. That's a choice that we've made. Also, compared with other states, relatively large shares of Minnesota's Medicaid spending go to high-cost individuals, specifically people in long-term care and people with disabilities. One of the ways that we assessed the state's financial management of health care was to examine the state's progress on previously identified cost containment strategies. Back in 2003, the legislature asked DHS to look at issues related to health care benefits coverage, and DHS had some discussions with legislators at that time and said, we'd like to do a broader study than that and look at a variety of areas in which there may be potential for savings. And so DHS hired a consultant, solicited input from a variety of people, and it issued a report in 2005 that could be viewed as sort of a blueprint for cost containment. It highlighted a variety of areas that it said hold significant promise for savings. Those were in both fee-for-service and in managed care and in state-administered as well as county-administered services. So we examined the status of the strategies that were identified by DHS in that report, and we concluded that the state's progress has been mixed. And what I'd like to do is to very briefly go through those strategies and just touch on kind of how we categorize the progress in a variety of areas. And let me begin with the areas in which we think there was fairly significant progress since 2005. First, DHS has taken important steps to implement evidence-based decisions on benefits coverage. For example, DHS hired a medical director, which they hadn't had for a few years. They created an advisory committee to help review coverage issues in high-cost areas. In the pharmacy area, DHS made several recommendations for legislative actions to rein in costs. For the most part, the legislature did not adopt those. However, DHS has taken actions on its own that have steered enrollees toward more cost-effective drugs, and in other ways limited pharmacy spending. Also, in the area of electronic medical records, we think there has been an important foundation laid in this important area. The legislature set an ambitious timeline for moving forward. The Department of Health has established some work groups that have been very active in the last year or so. So we think that there has been a considerable momentum in this area. Some areas in which we assessed there to be a moderate progress. First, as you know, people with chronic illnesses account for a disproportionate share of healthcare costs. And until recently, efforts to manage the costs and the care in fee-for-service for this population have been fairly limited. But during the last couple of years, the legislature has implemented some projects and some pilot efforts that we think are a good start in this area. Likewise, DHS is in the early stages of implementing a new managed care program that covers basic health care for people with disabilities. We've certainly heard some concerns about how that's going to work out in practice. It's very early in the early stages of implementation. Counties and advocates for people with disabilities have expressed some concerns about how the health plans will actually do in this area, but we think that there has been some significant progress just to get the program off the ground at this point. In the area of personal care attendants, the 2005 report proposed improvements in oversight and training, and we do think that there have been some improvements in that area. But we also think that there are lingering questions about that program's fiscal integrity.
And we hope that someday soon you'll be doing an oversight study in this area to help us.
Madam Chair, it's on our list of potential topics for next year, and I know there's some interest in that. And then the last area where we assess there to be moderate progress is DHS had suggested a need for improved oversight of county performance, especially in the area of home and community-based services. There have been some things that DHS has done there are some regular reports that are now being done county by county in this area. So we think there has been some movement in this area as well. And finally, some areas where there have been, in our judgment, limited progress. First, as you know, health plans that contract with the state are required to implement disease management programs, and these are another way of trying to improve the management of care for people with chronic illnesses. At this point, DHS has not gone in as it had proposed and kind of looked at the lessons learned from what the health plans have done in this area. And so we think it's unclear at this point which of these programs are cost-effective or if the overall approach is cost-effective. Also, DHS had proposed in 2005 that there be a greater look at consolidating certain administrative functions in small counties. That really hasn't happened, at least nothing real concrete to date. DHS said there was a need to better focus its contracts with managed care organizations on a limited number of key performance goals. There has certainly been a lot of discussion about this between DHS and the health plans, but not a lot at this point to show for that. In the area of case management for people in waivered services, there have been several reports to the legislature in the last few years and some good suggestions in those reports, but again, not a lot has been done to address the problems, some good discussions, but not a lot of concrete progress to date. And finally, DHS's 2005 report identified some specific pilot projects that it said might help to reduce Minnesota's reliance on nursing facilities. DHS chose not to pursue those particular strategies. Overall, what we say about this report is that it was certainly a good starting point, but it needs follow-through. And so what we suggest is that DHS come back to the legislature in 2009, give you an update on what they've done or what other agencies have done or what the legislature has done in these areas. And if there's a need to identify new strategies, maybe the ones that were identified in 2005 weren't the right ones, or maybe there are better ideas that are coming along, that would be an opportunity for DHS to say, here are some better options to put on the table. I want to turn next to the area of managed care and to talk about costs to begin with. And specifically, we looked at costs in Minnesota's managed care program over the 2000 to 2006 period. During that time, spending for medical costs grew at an annual rate of 19%. Or if you look at the increase in cost per employee, it was about 12% per enrollee. Meanwhile, the administrative costs, shown in red, grew during this period at 14% annually, or about 8% per enrollee per year. These costs grew faster than the enrollment increases, which were around 6% during this period. In addition, one of the things we did was to tap into the federal cost database, which has information on all states, to try to find out how our rates of cost increases in managed care compare with those in other states. What we found is that Minnesota's spending per enrollee for managed care grew at a faster rate in recent years than that of the nation as a whole. It's a little bit hard to isolate the reasons, and undoubtedly there are many for the cost increases, but one thing to point out is that during this period, we did implement on a statewide basis the MSHO program for seniors. With that implementation, there is Medicare money that is being blended into what was previously Medicaid money, and so there is some new revenue being reflected in here, and that may be one factor of the increased spending, but certainly that's just one of many factors going into the equation. As we say in the report, managed care certainly could be a tool for helping to contain costs, but it offers no guarantees of that. And let me discuss a few of the reasons for that. First, it used to be the case that the federal government required states to set their managed care rates at levels that would ensure that the services would not be more expensive than the states would be spending through a fee-for-service arrangement. Since 2003, however, the federal requirements have been different. They have required states instead to show that their managed care rates are actuarially sound. And it's a little unclear exactly what that means and how to interpret that. But generally, when the actuaries have gone in and have made recommendations for how to adjust the rates and set them, they have based their recommendations on past cost trends. And so there's concern that the approach that's used, using an actuarially sound approach, may be inflationary. Second, there are quite a few studies out there that show studies that have been done nationally and in other states. Many studies have shown that managed care has led to cost reductions compared with fee-for-service. But I would also say there are competing studies that show that in some cases, managed care is more expensive, or in some cases, it's a wash. So the studies have not been particularly conclusive. And I would also add that the outcome studies that have been done also show mixed results, that in some cases, managed care leads to better outcomes, which may in turn lead to lower costs over time. But also some studies show the opposite result. So the studies have not been very conclusive overall. Third, the ability of managed care to contain costs depends in part on how well DHS does in driving a hard bargain when it negotiates rates with the health plans. If DHS does not drive a hard bargain, then the health plans might be keeping savings that otherwise would accrue to the state. In the most recent year for which we looked at data, which was 2006, the net income of the health plans was not tremendously large. It was a positive net income, but it was smaller than it had been in previous years. But I should say that in prior years, health plans' net returns were usually better, and oftentimes we saw that the returns exceeded the targets for those returns that had been set by DHS. And finally, in looking at the health plans' returns, we observed that their levels of capital reserves have grown quite a bit in recent years, which is an indicator of their financial health. The question remains, did the reserves grow by too much? And that's a harder question to answer. Our state, like nearly all other states, does not have upper limits in the law as to reserves. And there's no real consensus opinion out there among experts as to exactly how much is too much in the area of reserves. Within managed care, we think there's a need for greater scrutiny of administrative spending. And it's true, as I mentioned earlier, that administrative costs are not a real large portion of overall health care spending. But unlike medical costs, administrative spending is subject to fairly little state review. Health plans reported administrative costs for public programs were $200 million in 2006. That amounted to about 8% of total spending, which, compared with other states, is actually fairly good. It appears that we're at kind of the lower end of the continuum compared with other states for which there was available data. I would also keep in mind that that 8% includes a certain portion of cost over which the health plans don't have a lot of direct control, namely premium taxes and surcharges, and those amount to about 1% of their total spending on the public programs. During the state's managed care rate setting process, DHS makes assumptions about how much the health plans will spend for administration. DHS does not actually cap or limit that spending. What we found is that over the last 3 years, health plans spent about $50 million more for administration than DHS had assumed they would. At the outset of our study, legislators asked, well, how much review is there really of administrative spending by state agencies? And the answer is that that review is quite limited. And let me briefly walk you through the three state agencies that have some role in this and just say a little word about the nature of their oversight. First, in the case of DHS, as I mentioned, they manage the publicly funded health care programs. They contract with the health plans. But what they don't do is really to limit the administrative spending when setting rates. Furthermore, DHS really doesn't look at the administrative costs in detail. They look at really an aggregate level of administrative spending as opposed to looking at categories, subcategories of administrative spending. And they also don't have information on the health plan's contracts for services. The Department of Health oversees financial management and quality assurance in the state's health plans. But they've had some cutbacks in their staffing in recent years, and so they don't have in-house staff anymore who review health plan finances. They rely on the Department of Commerce. They have an agreement with Commerce. But one of the things we observed in this report is that that agreement does not real clearly spell out the roles of health and commerce in looking at the reasonableness of health plan spending. And finally, the Department of Commerce really takes a very big picture look at the finances of health plans. Commerce doesn't review individual programs, such as the public programs. It doesn't isolate on them, and it doesn't isolate on subcategories of expenditures like categories of administrative costs. And again, the state rules require Commerce and Health to every 3 years look at the reasonableness of health plan spending, but this has been done at a very high level, not in detail. Over the last 20-plus years that the state has relied on managed care for its public programs, there really has not been a definitive demonstration that Minnesota's managed care programs are more cost-effective than fee-for-service. But we do think that there have been some practical advantages that managed care has offered compared with fee-for-service. First, we observe that through the contracts that the state negotiates with each of the plans, that by contracting with a limited number of health plans, we have had some leverage, outcome measurement, over access, over some cost control provisions. And that's something that in fee-for-service, where we have literally thousands of providers around the state, it's frankly harder to have the same amount of leverage that we have as a state with the health plans through these contracts. Second, there is information on the performance of the health plans and how that performance compares with some national measures. In contrast, in fee-for-service, we frankly have very little information on the performance of the public programs. And what I can say on the managed care side is that generally Minnesota's health plans have done pretty well on measures of service delivery and enrollee satisfaction. Third, enrollees in managed care get more information than do fee-for-service clients on the services that they're eligible to receive. Also, the managed care clients have more opportunities if there's a problem that arises. They have more appeal options. There's an ombudsman for managed care at the state level. So there, again, is a difference between managed care and fee-for-service. Fourth, as I mentioned earlier, because of the capitation payments that we use in managed care, the state has limited its financial risk in a managed care approach. And I know that as we talked with some people about practices in years gone by when the state relied more on fee-for-service, it was not unusual for there to be overspending in that area because there were less controls over the state spending levels. Finally, it seemed that the efforts that we observed that health plans were making to actively engage their members in health improvement activities were a good thing, and they contrast with the traditional fee-for-service approach, which has been, frankly, I think more low-key, less coordinated, a little less proactive than what we saw on the managed care side. So let me turn to the recommendations, first in managed care. And again, our overall conclusion is that we think Minnesota entered into managed care in its public programs with reasonable intentions. Even though we haven't demonstrated conclusively exactly how that has worked out, it's been a fairly stable system. And from what we've observed, the levels of customer service have been fairly good. Still, we have a number of recommendations in the report, and let me touch on a few of the key ones. We think that because Minnesota's managed care system has high and growing costs, one of the areas to focus on is the scrutiny of administrative costs in the public programs. And we think that should begin with DHS because of its role in setting the rates and negotiating the contracts. We also think that DHS needs to better define which administrative costs can be included for rate-setting purposes. And we even think it should consider caps or other incentives to control administrative costs during the rate-setting process. I noted earlier that the levels of return that the health plans have received from the public programs have sometimes exceeded the targets set by DHS. In some cases, they have the plans have not broke even at all, and that has consistently been the case in the GAMC program. In either case, we think that DHS should help legislators in the future to understand the reasons for those differences. Why is it that the returns of the health plans are, in many cases, doing as well as they are, or in GAMC, perhaps not doing well at all? For rate-setting purposes, we recommend that DHS count health plans' interest income as a type of revenue. It has generally been excluded in the past. Also, we suggest that to ensure more consistency in cost reporting, there should be clearer guidelines for how the health plans report their costs. And this is important because there needs to be consistency in the way that health plans distinguish, let's say, their commercial and their public lines of business and what gets reported where. But also there needs to be consistency in the way there is reporting for the various public programs. And so we suggest that the Department of Health provide more guidance in that area. In addition, we observe that the Departments of Health and Human Services have both collected and reported information on health plans' performance levels, but curiously, they've used different methods to do this, and it's been confusing to have them using different methods. We suggest that getting agreements on the methods for calculating the performance of the health plans would be a first step, frankly, toward getting agreement on how to improve performance by the plans. And finally, we have a number of recommendations for the legislature. Earlier, I suggested that DHS should play a more active role in reviewing administrative costs, but that may not be enough. We also suggest that you consider a stronger role for the Departments of Health and Commerce. As I mentioned before, DHS relies considerably on information it gets from Health and Commerce in the rate-setting process. Also, Health and Commerce play a role by rule in a review of the reasonableness of health plan spending. So part of our message is that if you want real oversight of administrative spending, start with DHS, but also consider that it's reasonable to ask Health and Commerce to do more than they're doing if this truly is a priority area. Another recommendation, currently information that is reported by the health plans to the Department of Health is classified as not public. In contrast, that same information, when it gets reported to DHS, doesn't have that sort of protection. And so what DHS told us is that they are reluctant to ask for us because for that information, because then they might have to disclose it to people who ask for it. We'd like to see DHS with as much information in their hands when they're doing rate setting and negotiating contracts. So we think that the same classification of the data that applies to information given to the Department of Health should also apply to information given to DHS. And finally, we think that there are some intriguing alternatives to managed care that could be considered by the legislature, even though we don't have a recommendation that the legislature specifically take some action in this area. But we do think that areas like doing some sort of direct contracting and bypassing HMOs are an area that have some promise for the future. And we think that the legislature should consider options like that, but it should do so with caution. There certainly is not a clear-cut answer one way or the other about whether that would be more cost-effective, but we think it's worth exploring and perhaps on a small scale first. I want to turn attention to a few recommendations in fee-for-service, and I should mention there are some areas that we identified in the report as problems in fee-for-service, but where we thought some recent actions by the legislature have probably set in motion some things that should be given a chance to work. So we didn't offer recommendations in all of those areas, but a couple of areas where we did offer recommendations. One is that we think the legislature should consider modest increases in fee-for-service rates for primary care physicians. Today, physicians in Minnesota under the public programs are reimbursed for about 30% of their costs. That compares with about 60% reimbursement rates about 17 years ago. So there has been a gradual erosion of those rates for primary care physicians. And we recognize certainly that at a time when the state is facing budget difficulties, it's going to be hard to consider that type of increase, and maybe this isn't the right year, but we do think this is something that remains, that should remain on the legislature's agenda whenever it can do so. We also point out that a few years ago, the legislature directed DHS to develop another revision to the fee-for-service reimbursement system, and this is something called a relative value payment system. It's used in Medicare. It's used in a lot of states' Medicaid services. And the idea with this system is it's intended to improve the fairness of physician reimbursement but be cost-neutral in doing so. And we point out in the report that the legislature asked DHS to have this in place by January 2007, but it has not been developed yet, and we have not heard any estimate of when it might actually be in place. And third, we note in the report that there is an ombudsman for enrollees in managed care, but we don't have that similar service for people in fee-for-service. And as I mentioned earlier, people in fee-for-service tend to be people who, in more often than not, who have disabilities or who have complex chronic conditions. And so there is certainly a need for some advocacy on their part, and we're not convinced that the current system provides adequate advocacy on their behalf. And so we suggest that at least the legislature consider extending the duties of the managed care ombudsman to fee-for-service enrollees. The final area I want to talk about today is county-based purchasing, which is yet another way that the state purchases health care on the managed care side. Back in the mid-1990s, when the legislature was expanding the prepaid medical assistance program, counties were concerned about whether or not the existing private managed care organizations would adequately serve the needs of the rural parts of Minnesota. And so the 1997 legislature authorized the establishment of county-based health plans. The map, and it's a little bit hard to see, shows the counties that, at least as of the end of 2007, had county-based purchasing in place. The dark blue counties are Itasca Medical Care. The green counties are South Country Health Alliance. Yes, the red counties are Prime West. Those are the three that have been in place up until now. These organizations have a lot of similarities with HMOs, but there are some differences. For example, they don't have to be licensed by the health department. They don't have to pay the annual licensing renewal fees that the HMOs do. We observe that there have been some close working relationships between the county-based purchasing organizations and county agencies in human services and in public health, and clearly that's a good thing. I think that one of the promises of county-based purchasing is the potential for integrating basic health care with other types of social services that these enrollees may need. So we think the county-based purchasing is an interesting option, was certainly developed for legitimate reasons, but we also think that there are some issues that should be addressed. Let me briefly walk through some of those. First, in aggregate, we note in our report that county-based purchasing organizations have had higher administrative costs than HMOs. That may reflect, in part, their smaller size. There certainly are some economies of scale that we observed in administrative spending. Second, county-based purchasing organizations have somewhat different capital reserve requirements than do HMOs. And specifically, the county-based organizations are allowed to meet those reserve requirements based on the fact that their counties have taxing authority. We think it's a little bit risky to just rely on that. It's a little bit hypothetical, and we'd frankly prefer to see money in the bank, so to speak, to cover at least a large portion of those reserve requirements. And I'll come back to that in a minute when we get to our recommendations. Third, there are not many statutory restrictions on how the county-based purchasing organizations can spend their revenues. One of the county-based organizations over the last couple of years decided, because it did have surplus revenues, to allocate a portion of those revenues back to the counties that make up the organization. And it did that, at least initially, with very few strings attached. And so for those people, and we heard from many of them who said, you know, are there really any limits on what the counties can do with that money, and could they be spending that money for road and bridge repair instead of health care? I mean, the short answer is there are not restrictions, for the most part, in statute regarding those expenditures. Not many restrictions on the exact nature of what those expenditures from public program revenues can be. County-based purchasing organizations don't have a real long track record, but we observe that there is room for improvement when we looked at measures of the quality and their compliance with state requirements. And finally, we observe that under county-based purchasing, the statutes sort of lock in, at least in some counties, those counties to providing solely through county-based purchasing. There is a provision in federal law, federal regulations, that allow counties in rural parts of states to have a single plan arrangement where there is a single health plan that provides the Medicaid services. And that's fine. That's not something that we take issue with. But we do think that there are questions that can be raised about whether it makes sense to lock in just the county-based purchasing organizations as the sole delivery mechanism. So here are the recommendations that we offer on some of these issues. Again, we think that county-based purchasing is an idea worth keeping. There have certainly been some growing pains, and we think that it should be monitored over a longer period of time. But one of the changes that we suggest is that there should be greater clarity in the law This should be for both county-based purchasing organizations as well as for HMOs. There should be, in our view, a statement in the law that essentially says that revenues that come from public sources for these programs should be used for health-related activities. There's certainly some room for debate about exactly how to define health-related activities, but we think that some sort of clarity in the law would be good. Also, we think that any health plan that has a contract with the state should periodically undergo a review process, one in which potential competitors are given an opportunity to submit proposals if they wish. And, you know, at the end of that process, it may be that the Department of Human Services reaches the judgment that county-based purchasing has served us well and should continue to serve those parts of the state it has been serving in the past. But we think that's a decision that should be reached through an open, competitive process that's done periodically, maybe every 5 years or so. Finally, we think the county should be held to a standard for their reserve requirements that is more like what the HMOs are required to meet. Again, we don't think it's prudent to rely solely on just the taxing authority of counties to try to deal with a potential emergency, a fiscal emergency that could arise in those plans. We'd rather see essentially money in the bank. So in summary, this report doesn't recommend turning Minnesota's system of administering the state health care programs upside down. We don't think there's a need to abandon the private health plans. We don't think there's a need to abandon county-based purchasing or even fee-for-service. But we think that within each of those approaches, there's room for improvement, room for better outcome measurement, better care management, better cost containment, and better customer service. And we also think that even though administrative costs are certainly not the biggest part of the budget, there is a need for greater assurance that the health plan's costs in this area are reasonable as well as accurately reported. So I will stop there and take any questions. And I should also mention recommendations from the report. There's a summary or a listing of the recommendations on page 125 if you want to see in one place everything that we recommended.
Questions? Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to just start out by been here almost 6 years now, and I just want to say how impressed I continue to be with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I want to thank Mr. Noble publicly for your work. It's excellent. Just a couple of questions. One is in your presentation, you said somewhat higher costs for county-based purchasing in administrative costs. When you say somewhat, does that mean did it kind of send up a red flag, or was it a huge amount? Or
recommendations,
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, let me give you the specific numbers, and there are different ways to look at this. One way is to look at the administrative cost per enrollee. And to give you a sense, and these are aggregate numbers of the HMOs compared with county-based purchasing organizations, the HMOs' aggregate administrative cost per enrollee were about $30. The county-based purchasing aggregate administrative costs were about $51. So it's certainly enough to draw your attention. There is a pretty sizable difference there. I should mention that two of the three county-based purchasing organizations are relatively new, just in the last few years, and they have been undergoing some transitions and getting up to speed. One of them has had very bare-bones kind of in-house administrative expenditures, so it's done a lot of its administrative activities through contracts with existing HMOs, and it would like to get to a point where it can do more of that in-house. It's frankly, for other reasons too, I should mention that in that organization, because they contract for those services with an HMO, they don't have access to even information on the individual clients they serve, which is something that's really essential for managing care and managing costs. And so they recognize that that's not the ideal arrangement and are trying to move to in-house administrative services. But again, there is some transitioning going on, mm-hmm. so it's something to monitor in the future, but that's where we stand right now.
And then, Madam Chair, if I can ask another question. So you're not really saying that you're saying that county-based purchasing is not necessarily a bad thing, where we just need to let it have some time. Did you also look at the county's administrative costs? Because in my two counties, Crow Wing and Morrison, when I talked to the social services director, it being that they have one plan to administer, it's easier for their staff rather than if they had two or three or four plans. The staff would have to, it would have a heck of a load to try to be up to speed on all of that. And so I think we have to be mindful of the county and their administrative costs and staff costs. Did you look into that at all, Mr. Nobles?
Mr. Chair, Senator Curring, I think that is an issue with the with counties, and it's an issue with providers as well who have to deal with multiple health plans. Mm-hmm. There can be an impact on their administrative costs. Again, what we see in the report is not that we challenge the notion of using single plan forms of delivery in certain rural counties. You know, that's allowed by federal law, and we think there's an argument for it. We just say that if we're going to do that, that there should be an open competitive process, and maybe it'll be a county-based plan that ultimately is the one that delivers the service, but maybe not. I mean, maybe over time we'll find that there are some parts of Minnesota, even rural Minnesota, that are better served by other plans. I should mention that even in some of those cases where we have, let's say, in the PMAP program, we may have some counties where they are single-plan counties where a county-based purchasing organization administers the program. In those same counties, let's say in Minnesota Care, there may be the county-based plan and a couple of private HMOs that are administering the service. So right now it's really a mixed bag. You'll find some single-plan counties for some programs in those same counties' competition. Mm-hmm. But I think your point about, yes, it is challenging from the county's perspective and the health plan's perspective, especially in small counties, to deal with multiple plans.
And can I ask one more question,
yes,
Madam Chair?
Senator Coyne.
What about, you know, another thing that you said is not adequate reserves for county-based purchasing, and then the counties getting money back. I was under the impression that any money, any savings that were realized, at least I was told a couple of years ago, any savings that was realized would be reinvested in to offer more, to continue to offer more services to the client. Is that the way it works, or?
Madam Chair and Senator Curring, again, it's an interesting question because each of the three county-based organizations do it a little bit differently, and let me briefly give you an overview of that. In Itasca Medical Care, and I don't have the slide up there, but those are three counties in northern Minnesota that are under Itasca. What they do is when they have surplus revenues, it all goes back to the providers who, in their case, share the risk. Normally, the providers in healthcare in Minnesota don't share in the risk with the health plan, but because in Itasca Medical Care, the providers have shared the risk, they say, if we have some surplus revenues, it's going to go back to the providers. And if we have losses, they're going to have to share the losses as well. Mm-hmm. So Itasca puts any surpluses back into provider reimbursement. Prime West, which is more in the western rural counties, Prime West has done it a couple of things. They also have used their surplus revenues to try to boost the reimbursement rates of providers in their area. And they've established a committee that every year goes through a process and says, how can we, as you said, reinvest our surpluses in other worthwhile health care activities? And so they've identified a number of things that they want to reinvest in. South Country is different. South Country has essentially said, when there are surpluses that we don't need to meet our reserve requirements, those are, I'm not using the contract language here, but it essentially says those are the property of the counties. And so they consider returning those surpluses back to the counties that participated for them to do with as they wish. Now, they have, within the last year or so, amended their contract language to say in their own contract that those expenditures from those surplus revenues have to be for health-related purposes, which is what we're recommending. And I think our concern is there clearly is more interest in county-based purchasing out there. There may be more counties that get into this in the future. And our main point here is that we not just rely on each of the county-based purchasing organizations to kind of set the ground rules, that there should be something in statute that says, here's what you can spend the revenues on and here's what you can't.
I understand. Mr. Nobles, or Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles, I just, again, want to thank you very much. Very, very thorough. I'm so very much impressed, so thank you.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Alter, actually, Senator Corrigan touched on a couple of my items, but could you elaborate a little bit more on the reserve requirements and how they differ for the HMOs as compared to the county? And also whether or not the counties carry any type of stop-loss insurance.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, the reserve requirements that are in statute, I should mention that at least a couple of the county-based purchasing organizations probably have reserves on hand. I mean, again, essentially what we're saying is it'd be better to have the money in the bank, and I think that at least a couple of the organizations would have that today. Based on their own policies that they've set, they do set aside money and have it there. But again, there's certainly no guarantee that as additional county-based purchasing organizations are set up, that they will pursue that same type of policy. And so what we're saying is that, and let me back up one more second, there is a unique provision that applies to the county-based purchasing organizations, and it's a little bit circuitous how this happens in statute, but there is a provision that says that for reserve requirements, the county-based purchasing organization can follow the reserve requirements that apply to, I'm forgetting the acronym, but it's the community-based networks, of which we don't have any in practice in the state right now. But that statute allows the reserves to be met by county taxing authority. So, and that has been the interpretation of the Department of Health and the Department of Commerce, that is, it's just the fact that those counties have taxing authority, that they can use that to meet their reserve requirements, whereas if you're an HMO, you have to have a more concrete evidence that you've got the money on hand, essentially. On stop loss, I'm not sure I have a good answer as to exactly what they've got right now.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Alter, do you think, would counties be able to put aside the required reserve, or would that prohibit them from being able to go into county-based purchasing?
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, again, my feeling is that at least a couple of the organizations probably would have that on hand today. And I think this is certainly a requirement that could be phased in as opposed to being something that you have to meet overnight if there's a concern that they might not be able to get up to speed immediately. But again, just to say a word about what our concern is, I mean, let's say that there were some sort of, let's say a pandemic flu epidemic that caused in our public programs some unexpected increase in health care expenditures and for which the health plans bear the risk. It would be, I think, logistically challenging, at least potentially, for counties who are in joint powers agreements, who do have taxing authority, to, in short order, kind of figure out how they were going to come up with money to cover those payments. It certainly, the potential is there certainly for some problems. So I think what your concern about, you know, would it be difficult for them to have the money and keep it on hand, is certainly a legitimate one. But I think as we've talked with counties, I mean, I think their sense is that that's not unreasonable. We certainly talked with the Association of Counties about this recommendation and with the existing county-based purchasing organizations. And, again, I think that this is not that different from current practice, but that should be applied to any future county-based organizations.
Madam Chair, I had Mr. Alter's name wrong, and I apologize for that. Sorry about that.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair. My question is back a little bit to the, I think it's slide 12, in which you're talking about managed care administrative spending. on our materials, it's page 2. You're talking in this at this point about $200 million being spent in the health plans in 2006 for administrative spending, which, and then you went on to say that that was in the range of $50 million over what was anticipated by DHS as dollars spent for administrative spending. So I was curious to know, was that $50 million a year? Is it $200 million a year, or was it $50 million of the $200 million is overspending?
Madam Chair and Senator Sherrin, let me clarify that because that's an important point. The $50 million that the plan spent above and beyond what DHS had assumed is over a three-year period. So, I mean, if we were to take about a third of that $50 million, let's say $15 to $17 million per year, in other words, on over that three-year period, out of that $200 million per year annually that the health plan spent on administration.
Other questions? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Alter, I'd also like to thank you for your testimony and really walking us through the history of managed health care. I think that's helpful, especially for those of us who are newer to this committee. We had a lot of questions about administrative costs over this interim, as you're probably aware. And even after all the committee hearings I sat through, I still don't feel that I have a really definitive answer with respect to what is counted when we look at administrative costs. And we had someone from Commerce, the Commerce Department, for example, testify to us in our healthcare pool working group committee that cost containment costs were not included in their calculation of administrative costs, which to me, if I was understanding that correctly, really kind of begs the question, because that's a very large part of what the managed health care, what they do. And so if they're spending money to control costs by basically limiting the delivery of services, and then that's not counted as an administrative cost, that would seem to me to be inexplicable. But at least with respect to some measure of when they're looking at how they're measuring administrative costs, that apparently isn't going into the calculation. We also had conflicting testimony with regard to whether stop-loss coverage costs are included in administrative costs. Someone told us that that's generally on average about 2 to 3% of the cost of delivering care is for purchase of stop-loss, but it depends, of course, on the company. Some don't even use it. So, but apparently we had conflicting testimony about whether that counts. I don't know whether that well, your chart did show that they're the state cost percentage of this, so you're adding state costs to the administrative costs. But then we also don't see an analysis of the medical profession's costs, administrative costs, in responding to all of the requirements that our managed healthcare system requires them to pay. We had one doctor, in fact, who said that, and I find this hard to believe, but his testimony was that felt he could reduce the cost of his practice by 50% if he were not having to make all the phone calls for approval of services and deal with multiple payers and multiple billing costs and employ the people necessary to meet all these requirements and performance outcome documents and all of these things that we've imposed through our managed healthcare system. So I guess I really appreciate the fact that you've acknowledged, I think, that we need to get a better handle on these calculations, but especially when we're not even seeing any real, I mean, we're seeing various studies about whether this is even providing any benefit in terms of outcomes. I think we should have a real good idea what it's costing us to do this. And then my second point in terms of comparison of fee-for-service to the managed healthcare system is in terms of what we're actually comparing. And I know you mentioned outcomes, but outcomes, the devil's kind of in the details there. Are we actually measuring the delivery of care? Or are we simply measuring, for example, that we've limited the need for care, which can then sometimes be a self-fulfilling prophecy? We all know that with a capitated payment system that there's an inherent conflict of interest when the managed health care system is able to keep the money that it doesn't spend in delivering care, and that there's a built-in conflict because there's going to be an incentive to want to not deliver care and keep more of the money yourself. So it seems to me that we can only fairly really compare those two systems if we're looking at how much care they're delivering for the cost they're charging versus how much care was being delivered under the fee-for-service system. Otherwise, if they're defining how these outcomes are measured, what I've heard from physicians is it's simply that they're rewarded for delivering less care, and then that's somehow looked at as a better outcome because, and yet there's, we can't necessarily say that there wasn't a need for more care. It's simply that they've delivered less care and we're calling that a positive outcome. So I understand that it helps the government minimize its risk, but are we really giving people more for the money or are we actually giving them less for the money? There was a study by, I think, a pretty reputable organization that compares the Commonwealth Commission. I'm sure you're familiar with that report. And in June of 2007, it ranked Minnesota's healthcare system overall as 11th in comparison to other states. And we did have some higher measures, 9th, I think, in terms of access to care. But in terms of care equity, we were 38th. And so when you're looking at what the managed healthcare system is delivering in terms of quality and performance, that equity measure seems to be, in my opinion, quite concerning. I can give an example in my area of with our county-based purchasing system, but also with before we were in it within a county-based purchasing system, we counted people as having dental care, but they had nowhere to go to get a dentist. And so we're saying that we're paying for certain kinds of care, but with the reimbursement rates as low as they are for certain items, if people don't have access to that care in terms of equity and fairness, people who are lower income or people in certain geographic areas aren't truly getting care. We're counting them as a number if we're looking at trying to extend universal care, but the care isn't actually available. So I don't know where my question comes in here. I'm sorry. But this is just a list of concerns I have with our managed healthcare system and where we're going and how we're spending our money that's kind of synthesized over the course of this last interim. And I wonder if, you know, somehow you could briefly respond to that.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, A lot of good issues raised there, and I'll briefly touch on a couple of them. One is the issue of what's included in administrative costs and what assurance do we have that everybody's counting things the same way. There are national insurance industry standards for how certain things should be reported on financial reports that all health plans are required to submit. And I should mention that in those standards, and if you look at the annual reports that are submitted, cost containment is, in fact, a category of administrative spending. And so, you know, there may be questions about whether everybody is putting everything in the right basket for cost containment, but it is explicit that that should be counted as an administrative expense in the financial reports. Now, having said that, again, one of our concerns is whether or not health plans are always consistently reporting their commercial and their public lines of business and the expenses that they incur, and that one health plan is doing it the same way as another health plan. And that's where we think there needs to be some additional guidance from the Department of Health. But in terms of kind of the overall guidance about what should be included as an administrative cost, there is some national guidance from the national insurance industry on that generally is followed. And I should mention, you know, we didn't do a financial audit. We didn't actually go in and audit the books of the health plans to find out, are they putting things in the right bucket? It is somewhat reassuring that at least those standards provide some guidance, even though we think there's a need for more. Another point, which is that, and I'll just, I guess, reiterate what you said, it is true that in administrative spending, the numbers that we presented here do not reflect administrative costs that are borne by the providers. What we're talking about here are the DHS and the health plan administrative costs. And we know that there is some level of administrative spending by the clinics and the providers. The problem is we don't have any statewide reporting that allows us to readily determine exactly what that level of spending is at the provider level. You expressed concern about outcomes, and how do we know within managed care that we're getting, I think, better value for what we're spending? You know, is it possible that we're spending less but getting less? And that certainly is an issue that we explored and discussed with people. And I think that perhaps one of the more compelling things that I can tell you on that is that the state's managed care ombudsman, whose business it is to be an advocate for people who are in the managed care system, so that if they are getting denied services that should be provided to them, if a health plan is making decisions in a way that wrongs them, they have someone to go to and express their concerns to. And having talked with the managed care ombudsman at length about this, my sense is that her feeling is that there are some issues, but that they are not huge issues in terms of denials of care that are inappropriate. She said that when those issues have been brought to the health plan's attention by her, that they have generally been responsive. So we certainly didn't get the impression from talking with the managed care ombudsman or from others, frankly, that there is kind of a crisis of health plans taking advantage of clients just to save money, even though that certainly was a concern a number of years ago. But we didn't get the sense that has been as much of an issue, at least in the recent past. Finally, on your issue about the Commonwealth rankings, which is correct, the Commonwealth Fund, I think, rated all of the states on kind of five global measures, and Minnesota did very well on four of those, which included access and outcomes and some other areas. The area that you mentioned where we didn't do well, which was an equity how did they describe it? It was a measure of the equity of the performance. And what that means is that there was variation among certain population subgroups. And I assume they were looking at, for example, racial and ethnic groups and how well some of those groups did on performance measures, that some groups did very well and some groups didn't do very well. There may also have been some regional differences, and I don't know for sure, but that, you're correct. That is an area that was more of a red flag in that report, whereas we were doing pretty well in other areas of care.
Mr. Alter, I have a question in regard to the $200 million that the health plans are spending for administrating our public programs. Does that include things like when they provide transportation to clients to get to medical appointments when they need the transportation? Does it include, I know it includes things that are not included in the private market. I just am not sure whether those things are included in this administrative cost or whether they are considered healthcare services that are being provided.
Madam Chair, Valerie may want to supplement what I say on this, but my understanding is that transportation generally is counted as an administrative cost. I know that certainly some of the plans talk with us about special initiatives that they've done to improve transportation of clients, and my understanding is that those are generally reported as an administrative cost.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, as we were advised by the health plans, we were told that if they could bill it as Medicaid, that type of transportation cost, it was billed for Medicare as a health care cost. Otherwise, it would be coded as a administrative cost.
So there's some of each, probably.
Probably.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make note here that we probably, if we did not provide care through health plans, we probably couldn't eliminate the entire $200 million. We probably would have to transfer some of those costs to the department. But even if we could eliminate some of it, it is not enough money to pay for the uninsured, as we often hear touted. It would not be enough to do that. I think some of the recommendations that you've made, though, in terms of, you know, having greater oversight over these costs and getting more administrative uniformity over measuring this area of spending, I think those recommendations are very worthwhile, and we really thank you for bringing for doing this report, and we'd like to thank Senator Laurie. He was the one who really pushed to get it done through the Legislative Audit Commission, and we thank you for the very thoughtful recommendations that you've made. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Madam Chair, this is a question more for you, I think, in terms of a historical perspective. I'm a little troubled hearing, going through the report, you know, that there's limited progress in some areas, you know, in particular with the disease management programs, and DHS was directed to implement pilot projects to reduce the use of nursing facilities, and we just heard that they did not pursue that at all, and the DHS has not evaluated the best practices in which interventions are most effective. And then on slide 17, there was a note saying that DHS should implement a relative value payment system and was given a January 2007 deadline, and there's no work done on that sort of thing. That disturbs me in the sense that, you know, we as a committee and a legislature work out details to address some of the issues going on here, whether it's cost containment or delivery of a particular health care initiative, and then when they aren't implemented at all, our plans
for doing. Senator, we can ask the department to come in and talk about these things at another time. I don't think we have time to take it up today, and I'm not sure they have the right people here or are prepared to talk to us about it today. But we really wouldn't have known about many of these things if we hadn't had this report done.
Right.
So this is just coming to light now.
Madam Chair, just a brief response on that. A couple of those things that you mentioned, for example, reviewing disease management to find lessons learned, or the pilot projects in nursing facilities, those are things that DHS brought forward in 2005. They weren't mandated to do those things by the legislature, but they said these are some good ideas that should be pursued. So in those cases, they were not mandates. In the case of the relative value payment system, that's something the legislature said, you need to implement this by 2007, and it was not. So there's a mix here of things that they initiated and things that you directed them to do.
Thank you.
Right, and even in the area where you indicate they've made significant progress related to evidence-based coverage decisions, I know that there's work going on, but exactly how much they've saved as a result of that work is still very unclear in my mind. So when we say progress, I'm not sure that necessarily is the outcomes are not necessarily always there. So, but we can review this at another meeting and get some more discussion about these items.
Thank you.
Are there other questions about the report? If not, thank you very much. Now we are going to take up the beginning of a discussion that we'll have throughout the session, I believe, about the Governor's Transformation Task Force recommendations. And we have with us today Commissioner Cal Ludeman, who was co-chair of the task force. We have Dr. Magnin, who is our new Commissioner of Health, with us to start us off here. And welcome, Commissioner. I think this is the first time you've appeared before this committee since you've gotten the job of commissioner, so we want to welcome you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I believe that's correct. And I'm glad to be here to talk about something less complex than the administration of public programs at DHS. I'm saying that kiddingly, because what we're talking about is health care reform and some of the recommendations made by the governor's health care transformation task force. The also with us today are four members. Madam Chair, you were a member of this task force as well as three other legislators. Also joining us today are four other members of this task force. If we can find the time, we would like to have them
Yes,
make some brief
we have them listed, and certainly we'll make sure those who can't come back get a chance Great. Today.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have Commissioner Mangan make a brief presentation about why we're talking about health care reform in this legislative session. And then I'd like to make some brief comments after she does that about the process and some of the recommendations in the most brief form as we possibly can. And we think we have some slides that can kind of describe for you and for this committee what these recommendations are like. So if that's all right with you, Madam Chair, I'll have Commissioner Mangan make a 10-slide presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I am pleased to be here today. I am Dr. Sani Mangan, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. And as Commissioner Ludeman said, we'd like to share some background. We often hear about how good the healthcare system is in Minnesota, and we think there are many good attributes about it, but there are many things that can be improved significantly, and we should not rest on our laurels and think there is not an urgent need to do healthcare reform. So I want to give you some background to that effect before we get to the actual recommendations. Really, the issues I think you know well about how rising healthcare costs are really unsustainable in the state. That healthcare quality, for all the money that we're spending, there's a huge quality gap between the care that could be delivered and the care that is delivered. We really, therefore, because of the cost and the quality, we have poor value. And the way that we actually pay for healthcare services actually puts the incentives in the wrong place. And with rising healthcare costs, it's very clear that the uninsured will begin to go up in Minnesota, which a state that has prided itself on having a low uninsured rate. So let me just give you some specifics. Cost, between 2000 and 2005, costs went from $19 billion in Minnesota to $29 billion, a 52% increase, clearly unsustainable. Let's bring it down to an individual employer level in trying to provide for employees. You can see here from 2000 to 2007 that there was a 68% growth rate. And that kind of growth rate for employers is really outpacing the growth in the overall economy. So if we really look at what's happening to workers' wages, per capita income, healthcare costs, and inflation, healthcare costs continued to exceed that. And in fact, you could say that all the money that goes into healthcare costs is really coming out of what we might be able to provide for increased employers' wages or employee wages that could be had. So you could say for all that money, well, don't we really get good care in this country? Well, here's a study looking at the percentage of U.S. adults who receive recommended care for their conditions. And overall, we're only getting about 50% of the care that we should be getting in the U.S. for all the money that we're spending. It also applies to children. Children are only getting about 50% of the recommended care that they should be getting, despite all the money that we're spending in health care. Truly not a very good value proposition. Let me bring it down to Minnesota. These were numbers for the United States. Think about a person with diabetes. A person with diabetes, there are five things that they should be getting that are related to what's called optimal care. So a person with diabetes, their doctor should be helping them be tobacco-free. They should be getting an aspirin that helps to prevent blood clots. They should be getting their blood pressure under control, their cholesterol under control, and their blood sugar under control. Five things that are considered optimal care. And when we talk about outcomes, Those are the five things that are most closely related to whether that person with diabetes has a stroke or a heart attack or a leg amputation or blindness. Those five things. Think in your mind right now what you think the percentage of people with diabetes in Minnesota are getting optimal care. What do you think that percentage is? Have it in your mind. Here's the answer. The answer is 11%. All the money that we're spending, we're only getting 11% of people with diabetes have optimal care. So we've got a cost problem. We've got a quality problem. We also, if we look at the root causes of illness in Minnesota, the top four preventable causes of illness and death are tobacco, physical inactivity, unhealthy eating, and alcohol. Smoking, we're making some progress because we've taken some really decisive steps to create a better environment for people to stop smoking and to protect workers. So we've gone from 28% down to 18%. Obesity, now remember, obesity is a combination of physical inactivity and unhealthy eating. So it's those two, the second and third preventable causes. We are not making progress here, folks. We're going in the wrong direction. The prevalence of obesity is increasing significantly in adults and in kids. And binge drinking, unfortunately, the Midwest here is not doing well in that area, particularly in comparison to the rest of the country. Here's just a graphical representation of what's happening with obesity and how the rates are climbing. So, cost problem, quality problem, root cause of illness problem. This is all going to lead to an erosion, and already has, of private insurance. So between 2000 and 2007, that we're seeing an erosion of that coverage. So the percentage of Minnesotans with health insurance through an employer fell significantly, and enrollment in public programs went up significantly, and uninsurance went up. This can be seen in a graphical representation. And the places on your right that have a star are places that are show statistical significance and those values going up. So an erosion in how many employers provide coverage, an increase in how many people are needing to go on to public programs, and an increase in the number of uninsured. We have a current payment system that's contributing to all these problems. Right now, the payment system is focused on individual services. In fact, the more that is done by a doctor or a hospital, the more they make. So it's actually there's very little incentives to try to keep people healthy and to keep people out of hospitals. And there's no incentives for individuals to actually choose based on quality or cost. And in fact, even if we had the incentives for people to be able to look at what the quality and cost are, there's very little information that's understandable to consumers. We're making some headway with groups like Minnesota Community Measurement to begin to make that transparent, what some of the quality measures are, but there's not enough, and we need to do more. There's really incentives that people would be involved in the medical arms race and to purchase more and more equipment and do more and more high-cost, high-margin services such as CT scans and MR scans than to really invest in prevention and the kind of care and care coordination that people need. Just to give you an example of how this could look, the whole concept that sometimes a different kind of care, that less care is better care. This was an example in which less care of less hospitalizations through a program at St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, in which they used nurse practitioners to work with people who had congestive heart failure. That's when the fluid, your heart does not pump as well, and fluid can back up. They used nurse practitioners. They helped people get scales in their homes so they could weigh themselves daily, watch for that fluid accumulation, talk to them regularly in between visits, and they were actually able to have less hospitalizations through this program, keeping people out of the hospital. So in this case, less care was better care, and it improved quality and saved costs. They actually saw a reduction of 82% of hospitalizations. They had a decreased length of stay because of all the care coordination that was going on, and the people were able to use care appropriately and not have to be into the emergency room because their congestive heart failure was not in good control. So we really need, as part of what to address this issue, we need a reform payment system that can improve outcomes for Minnesotans, can keep them healthy, keep them out of the hospital, keep them out of doctor's offices, and well in their homes, in their communities, and their jobs. Improve the coordination and delivery of care. Create it so that we are transparent about what the prices and quality of care really are in Minnesota, and to help consumers and individuals be able to choose care in a way that's based on their preferences and their needs and fits with their pocketbooks and their employer's coverage. And allow providers flexibility to be able to do programs like St. Mary's Duluth Clinic did. What I failed to mention is that although that program at St. Mary's Duluth Clinic improved quality and lowered cost overall, for the providers that were providing it, they lost money because of our current payment system. The incentives are not aligned for providers to have flexibility to innovate and do care in a way that leads to improved quality and lower costs. So at this point, I'd like to, with that background, hopefully I've given you about how our healthcare system in Minnesota, although there are some many good things about it, and we have a great position in which to improve from. We have increasing costs that are unsustainable, quality that leaves much to be improved, which is leading us to a poor value proposition for people in Minnesota, which is going to lead to less people being have coverage and will lead to a higher uninsured rate. So with that kind of background, and I'd like to turn it over to Commissioner Ludeman to tell us more about what the Governor's Healthcare Transformation Task Force recommended for next steps to build on this.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. Our charge was by February. We made that deadline to develop an action plan to improve Minnesota's healthcare status and to deal with the healthcare issues of affordability, access, and quality. This is all based on the premise that healthcare cost containment had to happen, and had to happen first before we could be able to accomplish what a lot of folks' ambitions are with access, quality, and affordability. No other state has looked at a program that would be able to first contain the cost of the system itself to change some of the things that the commissioner was talking about to be able to accomplish that. The key recommendations are we're trying to put them in the smallest packages that we possibly can to have folks understand what the task force recommendation is trying to do. First of all, improve public health. We can't deal with the tide of obesity and its effects on healthcare status and the healthcare cost unless we do more about that. Tobacco is the same way. Some of us are more chronologically gifted than others, but we can't stop the age wave from happening, but that also will have a direct impact on healthcare costs in Minnesota. Then improve the quality, cost, and the patient-centeredness of our healthcare system to bring the physician and patient closer together to make some more accountability structure within what the patient, the physician, the nurse practitioner, the registered nurse in those clinical environments can do together to make sure that that health status is improved is the first thing that you have to do to start to reduce that cost. The commissioner talked about restructuring the payment system. We will not have enough time to talk about this at great length today. This is the most controversial part of this this recommendation, but it is trying to get us off the dime from paying for volume and paying for quality and paying for health care in the right way so that we improve the health status and rather than have physicians scheduled 32, 35 office visits a day so that they've increased their throughput so that they can maintain the viability of their business environment in the clinic, but now we're left with 6 and 7 minute office visits. And so this is what Mr. Wesner, I'm taking his words from him a little bit, but this is called the tyranny of the office visit. And so our primary care physicians are under this kind of pressure, and the payment system continues to feed that delivery system as it is. So we've talked about some levels of payment reform within this task force report that we may have to come back and talk to you about. Otherwise, some of our folks that testify today could give it some more example. It is also to reduce the overall size and the cost of the health care system in and of itself. Minnesota is fortunate. We're interested in seamless transition and seamless transformation, but it has to be big and bold enough so that we can repackage our care delivery system at the provider level. Engage consumers finally in how they have, what they have to do in improve their health status, and certainly inform them on what that has to do with the cost of health care, both for them and for their employer and for the all other citizens in the state of Minnesota. And also to then ensure that we have a better access and affordability for the health insurance coverage system that exists in Minnesota today. To do this in a seamless manner and yet be big and bold enough to help to actually accomplish this cost containment is the trick. The last chart, which I, did you already go past that? It was the best chart we had going, too.
Well, we do have it handed out.
Oh, you do have it handed out. Right.
Sure. Oh, there it goes.
There. This is the square. This is talk about how, if we're going to talk about providing access to a quality, affordable health care system, Minnesota is the one state that can make this promise. We have to do these other four things that we've talked about. In the lower left-hand corner is this prevention and health promotion to give more focus to this in these areas of tobacco and obesity, particularly alcohol. I would also include in this category so that we can improve the health status and start to stem the tide of the new entree into the healthcare system that is at extraordinary cost. The other one is administrative efficiency and information infrastructure. I believe that 2008 will be a new year of price and quality transparency. Minnesota is getting extremely good at this. There is no other state that has a ICSI, a Institute of Clinical Systems Improvement. There is no other state that has a Minnesota Community Measurement or anything like it in this nation. And we need to exploit that capacity in this state to make sure that we have more and more transparency in the system. We also are going to have more what is called price transparency about what even individual procedures or episodes of care will cost in Minnesota, which will influence this black box that exists between the insurance and our provider system and the consumer. And as we put windows into this black box, we will be able to look into it and see what some of these true costs are. You also know that the legislature, with the help of the legislature, we have new administrative mandates for administrative simplicity in coding, and some of the electronic transfer of claims information will happen more automatically and more efficiently in Minnesota, better than almost any other state. Insurance market reform, part of this recommendation is the development of an insurance exchange, sometimes called a connector, so that particularly for the individual and the small group market, there would be a change in the delivery system and the transparency of what product design can be put into this exchange for individuals and small groups to be able to access. Payment reform on the upper left-hand corner is this more complicated system that more people can speak to better than I can. Basically in three levels, the establishment of a medical home and the rigor and certification that we would demand out of what a medical home would be, care coordination at the provider level, not at a disease management level provided by managed care organizations, but give more focus at the provider level, and what is called this level three, total cost of clinical care. So the risk is at the medical cost level. It does not completely excise the insurance company from this environment, but we have to have more imagination, I think, so that we can see what kind of reform this could be in building these virtual associations or real integrated system that we have established in Minnesota that can finally get us some real comparability, competition at the provider level rather than at the health plan level. The last item is sort of the promise that we're trying to make with healthcare transformation. It'll take a second. You have it in front of you. This is rather than have continue in the medical arms race, we may have more focus now on population health and more knowledge in the hands of consumers so that they can fight this fight of keeping themselves healthier and those around them. And we can be less focused on sick care or and get more focused on preventive and planned care at the individual and provider level. The invisibility of quality and cost will not any longer be tolerated in Minnesota. We are going to have as visible cost and quality information as we possibly can in the hands of every Minnesota consumer, employee health benefit manager, every CFO, every CEO, every public health manager, and every member of the legislature. We also wanted to make it, we have this focus of this volume that I call visit-centered care. We're trying to make it patient-centered care so that it isn't about how many times you go to the doctor that counts about your health care status. It's your health care status that counts, whether that leads to a visit with the primary care physician or specialty care is not the point. We have a good system that can provide that kind of quality. The question is whether you need that or not, and you can help with your physician make those decisions. We also have very fragmented care between our referral system, our insurance system, and our provider system that has a whole vast array of very integrated systems that we have in Minnesota to a one or two or three physician primary care clinic. We can make better progress in making sure that they are connected so that this care is not fragmented, and some folks are taking more responsibility for that delivery of coordinated care at the provider level. A lot of waste and rework happens in Minnesota, as across this nation. There's reasons for that, some of that for defensive medicine purposes or other things that we talk about in the waste of the system. We worry that sometimes in the back office there's a lot of activity going on that adds to the cost that has little to do with the physician's visit with you as a patient or the interaction between a nurse practitioner or an RN or some of our high-quality healthcare professionals in Minnesota. There's a lot of interference and a lot of interaction that is not necessary. The other one is the incentives for the endless inflation of medical care seems relentless in Minnesota and across this nation. We've adopted and assumed that medical trend is medical trend, and we have not done enough to fight it. And so we have not put incentives in the hands of the consumers. We have not put incentives in the hands of the providers, and we've not even put incentives in the hands of the health care or health plans in Minnesota to be able to change our system of medical trend. We need not accept that. And I, Madam Chair, you've talked about the also another tyranny of the status quo. The status quo of our health care system and our medical trend in Minnesota is unacceptable. And so what you will hear from the task force members is this energy that they will talk about better than I can express about this unacceptability of the status quo. And so while this may look too big and too bold, not incremental enough for the kind of changes that we need in Minnesota, we think unless it's this transformational, we will not get cost under control in Minnesota. Madam Chair, that's my few words for today, and I think we need to get
I think we'd like to hold questions until we get the task force members' testimony, and then we'll take questions of everybody at the end here. So next I'd like to call on David Wesner and Charles Montreal to come forward. And
Madam Chair and committee members, it's a pleasure to be with you today and talk about this work of transforming the healthcare system in Minnesota. We do have a system in health in Minnesota that it does a lot of things very well, but it is in great need of transformation, and there is great urgency about us finding the waste that is in the system today and the way in which the optimal health is not achieved. So that's what I would like to speak to. I am David Wessner. I am the Chief Executive Officer of Park Nicollet Health Services, a Twin Cities health care provider. What I think you have in the report from the Transformation Task Force is a blueprint that accomplishes what's known in healthcare circles as a triple aim, and that is when we are able to improve the health of all citizens, improve the patient experience, each individual's experience with healthcare so that it is uncompromised, and control per capita costs. To do that, to do all three of those things is critical and is the hard part about healthcare. We certainly want an experience that is uncompromised for ourselves or for our loved ones, family member, neighbor. We also need to have accountability around the cost, because healthcare costs today are preemptive of so many other important priorities that we have as individuals, as families, as corporations, as government. There are many things to do, and healthcare is consuming too much. The best way I know to start to describe the perspective from the healthcare system is to build a little bit on Dr. Mangan's comments about congestive heart failure. At Park Nicollet, we've been part of a demonstration project with Medicare that took on the approach to care with congestive heart failure. And in an effort to save money, we set up five nurses who actively managed by phone the care of about 600 to 700 congestive heart failure patients. And as a result of that, we were able to see a reduction of admissions to Methodist Hospital of 60 a month, 60 fewer crises of these individuals. That's an emergency room visit, that's an intensive care stay, and that is a permanent reduction in their health status with each one of those admissions. For every dollar that was spent on planned care, there was an avoidance of $6 of acute care, emergency, acute, difficult care. That is the type of innovation that we want to enable, encourage, and reward with the reform recommendations that are part of this task force. So I believe the recommendations that we have actually set up that type of environment to accomplish that type of change. Payment shapes care. And today we have payment that is shaped by insurance benefits, and it pays for response to acute symptoms. And it repays for an office visit. And as Commissioner Ludeman said, using the term the tyranny of the visit, it means that whatever the needs of the patient are, we need to shape them into a clinic visit in order to get paid. And so regardless of what those needs are, even though, as back to the example of the congestive heart failure patient, the need was the modification to medication in the morning that could be done simply and easily by a phone call, that was what the patient's need is. Right now, the system only pays if, in fact, there is an office visit. So as a result of that, today, we have yet to be paid for our congestive heart failure program. We're still working on trying to set up that, but that's the type of innovation that we really need to do. Payment shapes care, and right now it is locking care in place in the current system, and what we're rewarding is volume, not results. So we want to set up something that changes that, and there are three levels that I might explain in the recommendation, three levels of payment. Maybe I could relate that back to the story of congestive heart failure and how these three levels of payment work together. The first level is to stop paying for poor quality and to reward higher quality. And so that means that if, in fact, there's a nosocomial infection, an infection that is gathered as a result of being part of care, that that would not be paid for. The principle is basically defective care or inadequate care would not be paid for. and reward higher levels of quality. So moving along as along in the percent of the five quality measures that Dr. Mangan mentioned around diabetes would get greater payment. That is level one, and we have some of that in play right now. There are examples of that happening, but it's insufficient to transform the system. We need payment for, and this is level two, payment for the coordination of care. This enables the systems like the congestive heart failure program or others for diabetes and other chronic conditions to be put in place and for there to be a team of individuals that supports patients on a daily basis to keep them healthy, to provide them just what they need, just when they need it, not by utilizing the healthcare system, by going to a facility or a hospital, but by getting the advice and counsel they need. That isn't free. It is less expensive than acute care, but it does take resources to do it. And so in order to set that up, we need what are called care coordination payments. It's a payment that would be to pay the team to do the work, and it would be led by physicians but not provided all by physicians. There's much of this work that can be done much more effectively by care professionals who are trained at different levels with different expertise, and that's going to improve the productivity of our system. And by the way, there's no way the demographics of the next 20 years are going to work with our current system. We just are not training enough people to take care of the number of people that are going to need care. So we need an improvement in productivity, and this level two payment goes a long way towards setting that up. Level three is to create an overall accountability for the quality of care and the cost of care. So regardless of how you administer health care in the future, whether it's a single payer or whether it's administered by plans, you still have to come up with the question of how are you going to control the cost of care. That is still the issue. And unless the cost of care is held in check, or reduce unless value improves, no one can afford the prospect of universal coverage, which we all aspire to. And so the question is, how do you accomplish that? Well, level three says who should be optimizing these three things of health and patient experience and cost? Whose job should it be? Well, popular opinion always goes to the fact that the doctor and the patient are in the best position to make the choices that need to be made in optimizing cost and healthcare needs. And it needs to be individualized and personalized and patient-centered. This level three system allows that to occur. It allows it to occur, but it maintains accountability for the system for the total cost of care. So it enables that for the individual patient for the right thing to be done, but it requires that system of care now to be accountable for the total cost and to study the patterns of care and learn from those patterns of care so that more efficient patterns of care can be approached and prompted, and so that together these care professionals learn and are able to continually seek greater value. That's the type of system that we really want. We want it to be soft, flexible, and patient-centered at the point of care, but it needs to be a learning system, and it needs to be pointed in the direction of greater value. Today, we do not have that. And the further you pull the responsibility for controlling costs, the further you pull that away from the doctor and the patient. If it is the job of the government as a single payer, or if it's the job of a health plan, the further away it is, the less flexible it is going to be for the patient, and the less it's going to be accepted by the public, and the less effective it'll be. So what level three is saying that we have accountable systems of care that people can choose with information about cost and quality, which organization or which care system of care they want to work with to optimize their own health experience and cost. And we think that that is setting up a system which will be green on an ongoing basis. It will enable not to just replace one system of payment with another, but it sets up the incentive so that greater value and greater health will be rewarded as we continue to learn and innovate. And that's the sort of dynamic system that I believe Minnesota needs. And I'll just close by saying I think that the recommendations here really move the medical arms race that we have seen, that's been sort of well documented in our community, to a focus that the organizations of healthcare, the many very strong, capable healthcare organizations we have in Minnesota, to be moving from a medical arms race to a real focus on population health, and that that will be where investment moves. And that's where we need to be innovating. And if we're capable of doing that, if we set this system up that's in this recommendations, I think that we really are setting up the future for Minnesota healthcare to be the leading system both nationally and internationally as a great asset for the people of Minnesota, but also the business in Minnesota, because that creates an advantage that will make Minnesota a great place to live. And we think that the healthcare system ought to serve the community and the state in that way. So I'd be glad to answer questions as we get further along, but I think that describes the intent of the recommendations.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Charles Montreal. I'm Vice President of Corporate Human Resources for the Carlson Companies in Minneapolis. You know the Carlson Companies better as the Radisson Hotels, Country Inn and Suite Hotels, and TGI Fridays restaurants, Carlson Wagenli Travel. I want to talk to you today a bit about what led me to become a member of the task force, why I feel so strongly in the recommendations, and how it truly impacts the delivery of health care for our employees and the importance of Carlson Companies and other businesses in the state of Minnesota and the delivery of health care. When I was asked to become part of this task force, part of the reason is I wear a number of different hats. Not only am I Vice President of Corporate Human Resources, but I am Chair of the Buyers Healthcare Action Group in Minnesota, and I'm also President of an organization called Bridges to Excellence, which is a pay-for-performance program that is national in scope. But before I began my tenure on the task force, I really wanted to be grounded in certain principles that I wanted to make sure that this task force achieved as a result of its work. And at our first session, as we went around the table to the task force members, every single member of the task force was concerned that we were going to put in 6 months' worth of time, energy, and effort. We were going to have a beautiful written report that ended up sitting on a shelf. So everybody tried their hardest to, at the beginning of this task force, to say we were not going to let that happen. So I started with the following four guiding principles. One, a new system must stimulate efficiency, enhance quality, and encourage competition by giving consumers greater involvement in the healthcare process. Two, providers need quality standards for continuous improvement. Three, red tape must be reduced by simplifying administrative processes and procedures. Four, data must be closely monitored to constantly improve the system. Members of the committee, those four principles were the guiding principles that led to the establishment of the Buyers Healthcare Action Group in 1988, 20 years ago. Now, there are two ways to look at this. One is that we've been chasing our tail for 20 years, and we haven't made progress on these four principles, or the one that I choose, the employers making up the Buyers Healthcare Action Group were visionaries, and that it's taken us 20 years to get to the point that the other stakeholders, both the state government, the federal government, and the other stakeholders in the system, to get alignment around those principles. So let me talk a little bit about what this means to Carlson Companies, and I think any employer that came up here could tell you a similar story. Carlson is a large company in many, many respects, but we are also a very small company in many respects. 50% of our business is franchise business. We have small employers. The Country Inn and Suites in Little Falls, Minnesota, the TGI Fridays restaurant in St. Cloud, Minnesota, are owned by small business owners. Carlson is the benefactor of being a large company. For employees that work directly for us, we can self-fund. We can spread our risk across our employees, across the country, and we can drive efficiency and lower our costs for our employees. Our franchise employees, those small business owners in Little Falls and St. Cloud and around this state, cannot join our health plan, and they cannot take advantage of the efficiency that we can deliver as a large employer. We are in the business of helping those franchisees flourish across the country, and so I'm coming here not as a large employer, but also as a small employer. Here's our dilemma. Our health, our business, the health of our business depends upon the health of our employees. Every company across this country says that their competitive advantages are their employees. And yet we know that our employees are not coming to work with healthy body, mind, and spirit on every day. The cost of health care is just a portion of the overall total cost of care. There are also mental health care. There is also productivity. There is also care and sick days at home for caring for sick employees. The total cost of care, when you add it up, is astronomical. Let me put it in a little perspective in Carlson words. We will have to sell 90,000 more hotel room nights this year to pay for the same care this year that we paid for last year. The incremental increase because of medical inflation, we'll have to sell 90,000 more room nights. TGI Fridays restaurants will have to sell 500,000 more hamburgers this year to pay for the incremental increase in the cost of care from last year to this year. This is a real business problem that threatens to swallow up not only the expense component of our organization, but when you look at the overall budget in the state of Minnesota, it threatens to swallow up the state budget as well. So that was what led us and drove us on this committee to be transformational, to be innovative. And so as we look at the Transformation Task Force, we had to ask ourselves, what could we do that would solve the problems that we're facing and create this sense of urgency that we can solve? Now, no one is going to tell you that the task force recommendations are a panacea. There were five experts in the audience to every task force member during these hearings. And we know that we were hitting the mark because even before the task force recommendations came out, we received formal feedback from many of these special interests and experts on areas that they could agree with and areas that they had problems with and areas that required more discussion. I look at that as a real victory. But the thing that we understood and we realized in this task force was twofold. One is we the employers cannot do this alone. It takes all stakeholders, including the state government, and all the stakeholders at the table in order to pull this transformation off. The good news, and that's the second point and second learning we had, we have many of the building blocks already in place in Minnesota. You've heard about some of them already. The Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement in Minnesota sets optimal outcome standards, practice standards for the clinics and doctors in this state. Minnesota Community Measurement is transparency in the reporting of optimal outcomes so that doctors and clinics can see and compare themselves to how well they're doing in the community, and they know how much they have to improve. And we have the Bridges to Excellence program, a combination of the state of Minnesota and private employers who try to add a different layer to this system, and that is to pay for performance, reward quality of performance. I think David is right in his statement that we need to get care to where it belongs. The patient needs to have care and direct with the physician. In the Bridges to Excellence program, we have a reward ceremony where we bring the best of the best clinics and physicians and reward them for their achievement of optimal outcomes. One of the learnings we made was that the success in a type 2 diabetic setting depends upon a certified diabetic nurse that works with the doctor in the doctor's office and works with the patient to get them better. It's not a disease management arm of a healthcare plan that sits somewhere else. And yet when asked, why don't we have more of these in our clinics, the response is, employer, you're not paying for it. We're not paid for that type of care. This is the work, and this is the ahas that this transformation task force came forward with and started its recommendations. I just want to touch on two recommendations that I want to ensure I lend my support to. David did a very nice job in talking about the payment reform, the level one, level two, level three. I know that will generate additional questions, but this is about paying for quality of care, not quantity of care. An employer that sits before you today, this is how they purchase care. How much is the administrative per employee per month fee am I going to pay to my health plan? Do you have coverage that has a doctor or hospital that maximizes coverage for my employees so that they have maximum choice? And three, what's the steepest discount that you, the health plan, deliver to me so I can look at covering cost? There is nothing in a conversation about how are you going to make my employees better. And the payment, the level three payment system focuses totally on how we need to be patient-centric in making the delivery of healthcare about making that patient better. Second, incentives. We need to align incentives so we are paying for quality of care. And again, the payment reform system does that. Carlson Company's foundation, its DNA, is the incentive business. Kurt Carlson became a billionaire through the Gold Bond Stamp Company by incenting housewives across this country to be loyal to the grocer down the street. And by rewarding them with for their behavior, the housewife changed their behavior and incented and went and showed their loyalty back to that grocer. That incentive, those incentive systems have to be brought to our employees, and they have to be brought to our practitioners who are providing the best of care to our employees. So in my conclusion, the future is now. We need to bring quality of health care to our employees at a sensible cost. These recommendations do that. We need to make sure that we're measuring the health of this state by the health of our employee population, the health of the citizens of this state, and measure that. And importantly, as we wrapped up our work at the Healthcare Transformation Task Force, I said that the question was, how are we going to implement these recommendations? And I said what we ought to do is take these recommendations and divide them between what do we need legislation? What do we need your help with? And what can we do on our own to make sure that we're pushing forward this agenda on these recommendations? And I'm here to commit to you that we've already, in the employer community, the Buyers Healthcare Action Group, and other members of the task force, we are already putting together what we can to move forward on many of these recommendations so that we lead by example. We show the legislature that we, the employers, we, the other stakeholders in the system, mean what we say, and we're committed to these recommendations. The question we're going to have for you is how committed can you be to putting forward your part of the solution that we need? Thanks.
Thank you. I know that neither one of these gentlemen can come back tomorrow or the next day, so if we have questions for them, I'd like to take those questions now, and then we have a couple other task force members that would like to add their thoughts about the recommendations. Are there questions for either of these gentlemen? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. I'll just say, first of all, right up front, that I'm extremely concerned about some of the recommendations coming from the task force, and I'm going to have a lot of questions as we go through this process. I'm concerned that it sounds like, just at first blush, the same type of a philosophy that led us to No Child Left Behind, the pay-for-performance type of philosophy that diverts money from one group and pays for another based on outcomes, when we can demographically say that we're likely to have better outcomes with certain populations than with others, and does not put the money where necessarily the care is most needed. So that concerns me. But I have a number of other concerns. I can say there are probably a lot of us that philosophically question the direction of this type of reform, which I would challenge as not being nearly dramatic enough and actually just kind of a reconstituting of the same arguments that managed health care made 20 years or so ago in order to take a larger slice of the health care dollar. I'm concerned about where traditional public health care spending, which has been diverted in recent years, some of the money we had in the tobacco fund, for example, not being put into public health care, and now we're going to be spending some of what we're spending directly for with health care premiums. I'm wondering if we're expecting some of that to do the job of the public health care system. But I'm my first very direct question, besides a lot of questions I'm going to have about the methodologies that are supposed to prove that there's going to be all these cost savings from going down this road, is how much is this going to cost to implement? Do we have a fiscal note, or do we have some kind of a study? Because we're talking about spending a lot of money, introducing a lot more red tape, a lot more money into management and oversight, a lot of things that the medical community has questioned to me, because we're putting a lot more of a burden on them in all of these report cards and reporting, and we're putting a burden on consumers who are supposed to continue to shop for health care like it's a commodity. How much is this going to cost our government to implement?
The I don't have a cost implementation number to give you, but I could comment on the question of is this a rehash of managed care of the past or not? And there is there are some very significant differences from health plan-focused competition. And that is that it says that healthcare professionals, and that may be a system of care that's organized as such, or it may be a county of people that of professionals that all rely on each other to team up and provide care for individual patients, that they would be accountable for the value that they bring to their patients. And I think that is an appropriate accountability for care professionals, and one that they are up to. Now, granted, it will take systems to do that, and we all know that there are There are great advantages in investing in the type of information systems that are going to link together the providers in a way where they are, where information flows and communication flows and things don't have to be repeated, and where there's greater collaboration of care. That is anticipated in this type of operation. But whereas it used to be that the health plan would have accountability or try to put a price out, this is we're saying that the doctors and the nurses and the organizations that are formed to provide care would be accountable for their results. And that those results would both be in the case of the health that they're able to produce, the experience that patients have with them, what that feels like, and also the cost. And that as a result of being accountable, then their efforts in improvement would be on delivering greater value next year than they did this year. And that is a very important dynamic to get going. If we had that, we would see a change in the trend or the trajectory of care from what we have today. And that change in trajectory is absolutely critical if we are at all going to be looked at being able to extend coverage to all Minnesotans. Because if we can't do that, then no one can afford the challenge of extending care to everyone.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, just two quick comments. One, I wanted to just thank and acknowledge Mr. Western for pointing out the medical arms race, and I am encouraged to see that that's an area of overlap between the Transformation Task Force and the Healthcare Access Commission, and that has long been kind of the elephant in the room and a difficult conversation to have, but one that is much needed. So I'm very appreciative of that. And to Commissioner Magnin, again, welcome to our committee. We're happy to have you. You and I have talked about the statewide health improvement plan, and I appreciated the comments about what can we do to be a part of this. I know in my own work group, we were constantly going back to, and what does the legislation look like? If this is the problem or this is an idea, what does that legislation look like? And with regard to that, in your report on page A10, and I think it's worth drawing attention to, you are asking that the governor include in his budget proposal fully implementing the statewide health improvement plan. And I know that there is a range that has been identified, and I just encourage all of us to be bold in that particular initiative, because I can think of almost no other example of an investment that we can make on the front end that will reap long rewards for the state of Minnesota. So I am encouraged by the fact that that's been duly noted.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Just a general question. Is there going to be legislation that is brought forth from the administration with these recommendations?
Yes. All right. Thank you both very much, and thank you.
May I say something?
Senator.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Rosen. I'm sorry.
It's very, very good to see these two. I apologize. I had a very important bill up this morning, and I really wanted to make it here, but thank you for coming in and testifying. I'm sure you did a marvelous job, and I see Ms. Reed in the background there too. But if I can just say to the committee, you have no idea the amount of work and dedication and thought process and thoughtfulness that went into this committee. And these are private citizens that took time off of their job, and they put together a very wonderful package that I think has great potential. And along with the healthcare access recommendations, I think we're going to make some health care reform this year. So thank you so much for coming in on your time, both of you, and it's really good to see you again.
Mr. Montreal, I would say that it hasn't taken 20 years for you to figure out whether you were succeeding or not. I think it's taken us 20 years to figure out that we all need to be trying to create the same incentives and purchase in the same way from the healthcare system. And I guess it's not a surprise that it took us 20 years. We all think we can solve every problem all by ourselves.
True, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we'll ask Sean Kershaw and Dr. Maureen Reed to come up to the table. A couple more task force members. Welcome.
Welcome. Thanks. Greetings, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean Kershaw, and I'm Executive Director of the Citizens League. If you're unfamiliar with the Citizens League, we're one of the state's oldest public policy organizations. We are nonpartisan, as I like to say, sort of violently nonpartisan in this partisan world. We'll look at any issue that matters to Minnesota's quality of life. And what makes us unique and different from other think tanks is we're an organization almost like a chamber of commerce where citizens and businesses and nonprofits do the thinking and do the help make the recommendations. Our tagline is common ground, common good. I served on the Governor's Healthcare Transformation Task Force over the last several months and found it to be an extraordinary example of diverse interests working hard for a comprehensive common good solution. The Citizens League strongly believes that we need a long-term effort to develop an informed consumer voice in the market for medical care by ensuring that all citizens, consumers, and organizations have sufficient information about the supply and the demand for medical facilities and the medical care provided in them. In a report we released in 2006 around the medical arms race question, Citizens League found that the market for medical care is supplier-driven, meaning that the balance between suppliers and consumers is tipped in favor of medical suppliers, which can result in more use of medical services, higher cost, whether or not quality is improved. The Citizens League concluded that information regarding medical facilities and services is not sufficient for a functioning market or an effective regulatory approach. Consumers aren't informed enough to get the best value out of the system when it comes to medical facilities and services, and suppliers compete to offer high reimbursement services. At that time, the Citizens League recommended that the state form a consumer-dominated council to begin medical reform efforts. The Citizens League is supportive of the work of the Transformation Task Force. In particular, we strongly support the provisions to build the necessary information system and governance structure to advance true reform and create functioning market medical care. We believe that this is absolutely essential for any other reform efforts to work. If we do not make a major effort to establish a functional long-term market in medical care, then we're left with few other choices besides the unsustainable status quo or more regulation. And I want to end by making three points. First is one of the things we're trying to do at the Citizens League is to talk about public policy very differently and to talk about it in a way as if every individual and every organization, every institution had a role in public policy. And one of the best examples of that, I think, is healthcare. That no matter what the government does, no matter what I do as an employer, no matter what my doctor does, if as a consumer, if at home healthcare consumption means fast food and TV for my kids, we're going to see the same production of obesity that the commissioner put up on the charts. We think it's essential that that reform include the role of all citizens and all institutions. This report includes shared responsibility, a role for the government clearly, a role for employers, a role for providers, a role for plans, and a role for citizens. I think, Senator Olson, if I can say, I think you put a great question on the table by saying, how do we make sure that this happens, especially for populations at risk? One of the things I think we feel strongly about at Citizens League is that it is about more than access. It's about an incentive system that expands access and provides incentive to improve care. And I believe I'll be corrected, but that the plan includes both risk adjustments for serving populations that are more risky and rewards for improving the health within those populations. And I think those are essential elements of any reform effort. Second, I want to emphasize what people have said and will continue to say is that we cannot de-link access, affordability, and quality, and that citizens know it. Minnesota is a national leader in all three. Our care is among the best in the country. Our quality remains high, and we have one of the highest rates of coverage. But despite that, as the commissioners said, our course is unsustainable. And finally, I want to talk probably most importantly about the possibility of reforming all three of these: access, affordability, and quality. One of the nice things about my job is I've been preceded by people that are a lot smarter than me, and I can take advantage of their wisdom. And one of the former executive directors told me once that politics is not the art of the possible. Instead, he said, politics is the art of making possible what is necessary. Madam Chair and members of this committee, health reform is necessary, more necessary now that you reflect that you're faced with significant budget shortfalls. Citizens know it. All employers know it. Physicians know it. Everybody knows it. I urge you to look strongly at our standing in Minnesota and the work of this committee and other committees to recognize that comprehensive health care reform is more than necessary. It is possible. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Reed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Maureen Reed. I'm a physician, and I'm working in health care reform at the state level, and that's pretty much all that I'm doing these days. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm very pleased to have been a member of the Governor's Healthcare Transformation Task Force. It's my job this morning to recap and summarize what we have done here with our commission, and also then invite the others of my colleagues up here and answer your questions. So what I would say is, and to get my mind around this, I think of this report as really doing, and this set of recommendations as really doing five things. First of all, it literally takes a meat axe to the chronic care conditions that are killing us. It reverses the axe murder syndrome and has us going after the stuff that's killing us. The stuff that's killing us is still tobacco, and it's going to be obesity very soon. And alcohol and binge drinking are on our list as well. What we've recommended in this report here are two avenues of approach. One is a very strong public health approach, and the commissioner has alluded to that. And the other are individual incentives to help individuals get their heads in the game as well. In order to make sure that we get results with tobacco, with alcohol, with obesity, we know that these are things that we have to make more expensive, less accessible, and less acceptable. And you will see in our report recommendations that have to do, in particular, with tobacco, in increasing the cost of tobacco, and in having consumers share part of the risk if, in fact, they choose to engage in behaviors that make the rest of us have to pay more. This is a very strong public health recommendation in this first recommendation, and it will require an investment. And I resonated with your question, Senator Lynch, and your comments about the importance of doing this. If we don't get after these huge public health problems that are with us, it almost doesn't matter if we do the rest, because it's still going to eat our lunch. So you're going to still be here 5 years from now and 10 years from now dealing with this problem if we don't bite off this public health aspect and be willing to bite it off big and to swallow it all. The second thing that this report calls for is a transformation of the care delivery system itself. And Mr. Wessner and others have already alluded to this. What we have called for here is, it's hard to explain if you haven't been inside and working in a delivery system. But as I look at that, and having spent years in delivery systems, I look at this and say, my goodness, we are asking our care delivery systems in Minnesota, as good as we think they are, to become something wholly different, to actually be concerned about the outcomes of their care, to be measuring the outcomes of their care, and to be very, very public with putting those outcomes in the public venue so that people can see what it is for the care that they are getting. This is foundational change, fundamental change when it comes to us asking care delivery systems to deliver outcomes of care, not just widgets, not just doing stuff. It's delivering what patients need. The third thing that we have touched on, and Mr. Wessner and Mr. Montreal have talked about a fair amount, is the payment reform. We have to pay for what works. We have to stop paying for what doesn't work. And I have in this report asked the care delivery systems to take responsibility not only for the type of outcomes in quality that they are delivering, but also the cost of care itself. We have, as you mentioned in response to your question, Senator Olson, exempted the care systems from being responsible for stuff that they cannot control, like the socioeconomic status of their patients other kinds of, for example, English-speaking status. That is exempted. But we've asked the care delivery systems to be responsible for what they can control and to be very public about their results. The fourth thing that we've done is we've put a very bright light on the total cost of the system itself and on administrative expenses. When you revolutionize the care systems and you revolutionize payment, suddenly the roles of health plans become quite different. And we have asked in this report that administrative expenses be streamlined so that as care delivery systems are doing more, like disease management, like putting their prices out for all the world to see, that that is not duplicated and made more complicated on the health plan side of things. So the administrative cost savings involve not only that sort of thing, but really requirements for electronic medical records and a very hard look at what should be an essential benefit set. Because we believe that it is difficult for this whole package to be affordable unless we define what is a standard benefit set. And that gets to the fifth thing that we have tried to do here. We have put in place here a method for being able to cover everybody. We have said that this is a way that people are in the tent. This is guaranteed issue. It's community rating. That means you can't be denied coverage because you're sick, and you can't be charged more because you are sick. This goes a long ways in remedying what have been some really deep flaws in our system up until now. And in doing those kinds of insurance reforms, we have also said that there should be a standard benefit set so that folks know what they are purchasing, they know what their own skin is going to be in the game, and that they can make comparisons, apples to apples comparisons, instead of sort of in a back room where you cover your eyes and you say, I don't really know what all this stuff is about. Let me just sign up for something, sign up for anything. So that is the fifth thing that our plan does, is that it makes sure that there is access and insurance coverage for everyone in Minnesota. And finally, it provides a structure that in which all of these things can take place. You know, when I was watching your work a year ago in your 2007 session, and as you were crafting this transformation task force, I was in the background just cheering you on because you put forth a very, very robust charge for us on this committee. You said you've got to cut costs by 20%. You've got to improve quality of health and health care in Minnesota, and you've got to cover everybody. And, oh, by the way, you said, you've got to do it by 2011. And we took your charge very, very seriously. We weren't able to accomplish everything by 2011, but the report shows that not only given the investments that we have to make, but given the cost savings, that we will actually accomplish your charge by 2015. There is no other state that has even begun to think about this, much less had a plan for doing it. And you rightly called this the Transformation Task Force. You didn't call it the tinker around a little bit task force or tweak it a little bit and see what happens task force. You called it the Transformation Task Force, and it in fact does everything. It is comprehensive, and you can't do part of this and hope to have a standing chair at the end of it. You can't pull out one leg and hope that that chair is going to stand. You are, and I'm very envious of you, because you are on the threshold here in Minnesota of doing something that no other state has thought about doing, and you're on the threshold of being able to accomplish it this year. And to be with a group of people who have that kind of vision and that kind of power, and I hope that kind of enthusiasm is very thrilling for me, and it was very exciting for those of us on the Transformation Task Force to take part in something that we believed would be so groundbreaking. So as you move ahead, you know that half measures aren't going to work. You know that your constituents are hurting very much because of the healthcare dilemma, the cost dilemma that we have, and we're very pleased to be able to present to you a recommendation that we believe satisfies the needs of your constituents and delivers to them what they want and what they deserve. So I will wrap up with from there and perhaps invite the rest of my colleagues back to the table.
We're actually not going to have time to take any more questions today, okay. But for those of you that can come back tomorrow, we will take questions and get into some more of the discussion if you're able to do that. And this will not be the last time we talk about this, obviously. We've just begun to kind of get into the overall plan, and there's a lot of details left to discuss. We thank you both for being here today, and we thank you for serving on the task force. We thank the commissioners as well for being here today. And with that, our meeting will be adjourned.
Go in a nutshell. They're planning.